This is Functional Medicine Update for February 2008, Volume 28, Number 2. Our topic of discussion this month is plant-derived vitamins and phytochemicals. Subjects to be covered in this issue will include the new era of nutrition, antioxidation, stress and function, aka mitohormesis, type 2 diabetes and mitochondrial bioenergetics, and disorders of the 21st century. Our clinician-researcher interview this month is with Dr. Marianne Lila, discussing phytochemistry and health. And we'll wrap up this edition with a look at estrogen modulation with plants and grapeseed extract and estrogen suppression. Now here's Dr. Jeffrey Bland and this month's edition of Functional Medicine Update.
Welcome to Functional Medicine Update, February 2008. Well, I'm going to say the obvious. We all know that plants make vitamins. What I mean by that is they have the biosynthetic capability of biosynthesizing what we call vital amines or vitamins. Thiamine, riboflavin, pyridoxine. They have this capability of producing the complex array of substances that are necessary to support mammalian metabolism and serve as cofactors and or antioxidants. They make tocopherols and they make ascorbic acid, vitamin C. And I was reminded as I prepared for this particular edition of Functional Medicine Update, it's going to be an update on the role not only of plant-derived vitamins on physiology, but also the literally thousands of additional secondary metabolites that plants make called phytochemicals, that's P-H-Y-T-O chemicals, and the role that they play in physiology, which makes this lexicon of bioactive components from plant foods much, much broader than we previously recognized when we were thinking that plants only made vitamins. We now recognize that this therapeutic potential of substances that come out of the plant kingdom is extraordinary, not just thinking of anti-cancer substances or antidepressive substances, but I'm talking about a whole array of hormetic substances, nutritional hormesis, as the topic has been identified and defined in previous editions of Functional Medicine Update. These small molecules that are found in foods that modulate signal transduction processes in a cell and tissue-specific way to induce altered phenotype through altered effects on the epigenome and genetic expression and proteomics and metabolomics, and this complex process that weaves its way, ultimately giving rise to the outcome of health of that individual, their function. It is the interface between functional medicine and nutrition, this transduction process that's modulated in part through these nutritionally hormetic substances. And that's going to be the topic of this month's Functional Medicine Update. So let's start, if we can, with a little back to the future discussion. I want to take us back in my experience to the early 1980s when I had the privilege of working on my sabbatical year at the Linus Pauling Institute of Science and Medicine. And in one of the conversations that I had during that two-year period with Dr. Linus Pauling, as you know, two-time Nobel Prize-winning laureate, in fact, as far as I know, even today, is still the only person to have won solo two Nobel Prizes in two different fields, one in chemistry and one in peace. And in a discussion I had with him about vitamin C, which obviously in his later years of his career became a major part of his focus, was the both nutritional and nutritional pharmacological effects of ascorbic acid, and being the proponent of vitamin C for the common cold and flu, which was one of the best-selling nutrition books in history globally, it changed the whole complexion of nutrition, nutritional supplements, the nutritional supplement industry, and even medicine to some great extent. Even those that railed against the concept that vitamin C taken in supplemental doses could have any positive health benefit still were challenged to the task of thinking about their discipline in a different way and looking at nutrition from a different perspective. So We might consider this the dawn of the new era of nutrition that we're just starting to witness unfold in the 21st century. Pioneers like Dr. Roger Williams and Dr. Linus Pauling really helped guide us into this new era. So when I was talking with Dr. Pauling in 1982 about vitamin C and was asking him the question that I'm sure he had been asked tens of thousands of times, it was, how did he come on to this vitamin C connection and his interest to it? He then went on to say that there were two reasons that he piqued his interest around ascorbic acid. One was his meeting of Dr. Erwin Stone, who some of you who have been in this field for many years certainly remember was a PhD who had looked at the evolutionary changes in biosynthetic capability for vitamin C in different animals, and that there was this mutation that occurred in the human genome that lost the enzyme L-glucosylation oxidase some couple million years ago, a few million years ago, which then resulted in the inability of humans to biosynthesize vitamin C from glucose, whereas it's able to be done in virtually all other animal species. So we just have the fruit bat, and we have the guinea pig, and we have the human that have lost this ability to manufacture ascorbic acid from the biosynthetic pathway coming out from glucose. However, as we've seen over the last several years, there are people who still maintain some resonant ability in their own genome to biosynthesize vitamin C, which is a fascinating part of the story. It's kind of a legacy from the past. They still have a little bit of that L-glucosylation oxidase activity, which is activated under stress. And as Erwin Stone talked about in his early works, and then later Dr. Pauling talked about, animals like the goat that synthesize 100 or so milligrams of vitamin C a day under low stress conditions, when they're put under high stress, will activate their biosynthesis of vitamin C some tenfold and produce thousands of milligrams of vitamin C. And the point that was made is the goat has about the same body mass as a human. Why is it that we don't feel that under stress we need more vitamin C? We can't make it like a goat does. We can't turn on our liver to manufacture more ascorbic acid from glucose. So maybe it becomes a conditionally essential nutrient at higher doses for us under physiologic or environmental stress. And that was a very interesting part of Dr. Stone's anthropological arguments and also Dr. Pauling's. So that was one feature that got Dr. Pauling very interested in the vitamin C ascorbic acid story. And the second was a personal experience, and one that maybe many of you are unaware of, but you can go back and go to the Linus Pauling Institute archives, which are now on the World Wide Web. They've digitized much of his correspondence and early letters, so those of you that are Paulingophiles can go back and find out a lot of the kind of conversations and communication that Dr. Pauling was having with scientists and politicians and policymakers and thought leaders around the world over this dynamic period in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s. I find it very interesting that if you go back into his archives and you look at the letters that were written in the 50s, were actually typed by him on the same typewriter that he was still using when I was at the Institute in the 80s. There were characteristics, you know, each typewriter has its own unique kind of thumbprint, and you can actually see this in the letters that were written back then that maintained that same compositional uniqueness in terms of the print style into the 1980s. So the 1950s was an interesting period relative to Dr. Pauling's understanding of vitamin C, because about 1950, 1951, at a scientific meeting that he and his wife Ava Helen were attending back on the eastern coast, and you recall he was at the time at California Institute of Technology in Pasadena, and back in the 1950 period, airplane travel between coasts was not common. And therefore, they were on the train to return back from this meeting in New York to California. And he developed a very severe back problem, and later became known by him that it really wasn't a back problem, it was a kidney problem. So by the time he arrived in California, he had very severe kidney-related inflammation. And he went at that time to one of the most renowned nephrologist at Stanford University School of Medicine, who basically said, you need to go on my program, which was a very interesting program. This is the Addis program, Dr. Thomas Addis, and it was a protein-modified diet coupled with, very interestingly, supplemental vitamin C at a high dose, which was at that time a very new substance that you could get in purified crystalline form. And so the diagnosis at this time for Dr. Pauling was Bright's disease, B-R-I-G-H-T apostrophe S, which is what chronic glomerulonephritis was called back in this period of time. All kind of kidney inflammatory disorders were lumped under one title called Bright's disease, named after the gentleman who discovered the origin of this condition. And so he was placed on this specific intervention, which was extraordinarily successful for him. And he became a real believer of this glomerulonephritis treatment and Bright's disease treatment with the dietary intervention by Thomas Addis at Stanford University with the supplemental vitamin C, had some unique characteristic that deserved his attention. And it was a combination, I think, of the Irwin stone and his own experience with Bright's disease and vitamin C that resulted in his then, for the rest of his life, interest intellectually and clinically and scientifically in the role of vitamin C in human health and disease. I find it interesting because, you know, it's often said that supplemental vitamin C causes kidney stones, and so people are very worried about vitamin C and kidney disease when taken at supplemental doses above 6 grams a day. But if you actually go to the literature and do a fairly significant and complete literature survey, you'll find that there are virtually only a couple of clinical observational case reports on kidney stones being produced by vitamin C at high doses in people that were marginally undernourished, so you already wonder what were the confounding variables. And there are a number of other reports indicating that supplemental vitamin C and taken with people that have urogenital infections or who have kidney inflammation actually had positive clinical outcome and effects on their situation. So I think that Dr. Pauling's own case experience was a very interesting point on the curve related to starting back in 1951, his journey down the vitamin C path. And of course, you know, it ultimately led into all sorts of things, one of which was the collaborative work with Ewan Cameron, Scottish surgeon, on vitamin C in cancer, which when I was at the institutes in the early 80s, this was at the heat of debate because there was a extraordinary work being done over the oversight of Dr. Mortel at Mayo, who found that vitamin C didn't have a positive impact on cancer outcome. So that was debated between Mortel and Pauling at some length and Cameron. And some many years later, coming up into the 21st century, we start to see retrospective studies being published that demonstrate that intravenous vitamin C does appear to have a positive benefit on patients with various forms of cancer in their energy and their quality of life and possibly even their survival, although that probably is still open to some level of controversy. There's a very nice review of this. It's published in Integrative Cancer Therapies, Volume 4, page 32 in 2005, that's entitled Orthomolecular Oncology Review, Ascorbic Acid and Cancer 25 Years Later, that you can take a look at. But we also see some very nice work that's been done by Dr. Mark Levine at National Institutes of Health, recently published. He, as you know, is an endocrinologist. It's been studying under very rigorous conditions the effect that vitamin C has on human physiology using in situ kinetics, and has been able to identify once again that there's, at least from a fundamental mechanistic understanding, a rationale for the use of higher dose supplemental vitamin C therapy during certain kinds of oncological events. So I think that although Dr. Pauling was discounted early on by many of his colleagues when he came to the concept of supplemental vitamin C as being beneficial, as we learn more over time and we recognize the multiple effects that these interesting small molecules derived from plants have on physiology, some of his conceptualizations look a lot more reasonable today in light of these new discoveries than they did maybe to some back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and even 80s. So I think that we should keep the jury out on this, but certainly the vitamin C story is a lot more than just the prevention of scurvy. I think we can say that with absolute assurity. So when we look at these questions of the role that phytochemicals have on function, they're often relegated to a simple term, which is antioxidation. I think that's essentially an oversimplification, because what we're starting to learn, first of all, is the term antioxidant is a very general term that doesn't relate specifically to how that molecule or collection of molecules interface with different cells, different tissues, different organs with specificity to induce differing cellular or functional outcome. And I think what we're starting to recognize is that these, quote, antioxidant effects really surround bioenergetic effects that these nutrients have by regulating cellular physiology in a very specific way through signal transduction processes. So we shouldn't generalize, I think, to just saying antioxidants. We ought to be talking about the specific role that those family of molecules derived from plant foods have on specific cellular functions. With that in mind, let's talk a little bit about what happens when you get dysfunctional bioenergetics. And one of the things that happens, other than clinically, the person is tired, worn out, can't think straight, has muscle mass loss, and their immune system is gone awry. That's the kind of gross effects that low bioenergetics has. In terms of the effect that it has at the cellular level, what we see is oxidative stress often occurring with free radical pathology. It could be from oxygen radicals, nitrogen radicals, but we've lost the ability to regulate these intermediary molecules that are high-energy promiscuous molecules called free radicals that can damage macromolecules like proteins, nucleic acids, or lipids and cause cellular injury. And so the concept of keeping the mitochondrial bioenergetics intact is a very fundamentally important part of any positive intervention program in nutritional therapy. And the reason I threw the term mitochondria in there is that the mitochondrion is the site of bioenergetics in the mammalian cell. The chloroplast in the plant is where a lot of the energy is transduced from the capturing of photons of light from the sun. The comparable site of reaction for that of function in mammalian cells or eukaryotic cells is in the mitochondria, the energy powerhouse, where oxygen is utilized, carbon dioxide and water is produced, and substrates such as glucose, fatty acids, and amino acids are burned as fuel in the process of respiration to give rise to an ultimate building of reducing power in the cell through ATP, NADPH, and other high-energy cofactors that helps to maintain structure and function of the cell. And that is powered by this furnace or energy powerhouse called the mitochondrion. As the cell becomes dysfunctional as a consequence of breakdown in the integrity of the cellular processes, it then translates into altered mitochondrial function, increased release of these secondary oxidants that we call free radicals that then injure the cell and cause ultimately cellular death or suicide that we associate with apoptotic changes leading to programmed cell death or to induced cellular death and pathology. So maintenance of mitochondrial function, as we've all learned, is extraordinarily important for the prevention of oxidative stress, and the role that, quote, antioxidants, end quote, are presumed to have is in some way influencing bioenergetics and mitochondrial function and preventing oxidative injury. So what is the effect of a sublethal mitochondrial stress on physiological function? And that has been the discussion in a recent medical hypothesis article, Volume 66, page 832 in 2006, in which they've talked about a term called mitohormesis. Mitohormesis, which takes the term hormesis, small substances having larger physiological effects, and applies it to the mitochondria. And they're looking in this particular article specifically at the role that dietary phytonutrients or phytochemicals have serving as mitohormetic agents, agents that stimulate proper mitochondrial function. So rather than talking about these phytochemicals as antioxidants, in this case, giving them a more specific role, that they influence the signal transduction process, what translates the outside world to the inside function of the mitochondria, and then regulates mitochondrial function to prevent it uncoupling and producing oxidants and engaging in oxidative stress. Under conditions where the mitochondria is lost its functional integrity, you start to have these phase transitions in mitochondrial oxidative phosphorylation and the production of more oxidants, the so-called uncoupling reactions. What we can then have is, even in mild mitochondrial uncoupling, impact on myocyte function, on muscle cell function, and that induces then sarcomeric changes, which then causes metabolic sarcopenia, the loss of flesh. And so you start to see injury to muscle and muscle apoptosis and lowering of muscle mass. And this may be a contributor to the process that we see of lowering strength and vitality with aging as we start getting this increased oxidative stress effect. I'm now quoting actually from a very nice paper that ties together this mild mitochondrial uncoupling and its effect upon muscle cell integrity in vivo and how that relates to cellular aging. This was presented in the National Academy of Sciences, volume 104, page 1057 in 2007. This is, I think, some very nice work that was actually looking at magnetic resonance spectroscopy studies, looking at phosphocreatine and ATP levels in muscle, which is an indirect measurement in the whole organism of mitochondrial function and muscle cell activity, and showing that even mild uncoupling of mitochondrial function led to a decreased muscle cell bioenergetics and increased oxidative injury in muscle cells. This is work actually out at the University of Washington, Department of Physiology and Biophysics, using NMR technologies to evaluate in whole exercising muscle of intact human beings their bioenergetics. So this is not just an esoteric topic. We can actually observe it even in fairly mild cases of mitochondrial uncoupling. These are not constitutive mitochondrialopathies, where we're talking about people that have inborn errors of mitochondrial genetics. Here we're talking about induced mild mitochondrial uncoupling that's a result of environmental factors, things like insulin resistance, metabolic syndrome, hyperinsulinemia, high uric acid levels, high inflammatory cytokines as a consequence of inflammation. All of these induce then alteration in myocyte mitochondrial function and cause mitochondrial uncoupling and oxidative stress. It's a little bit like a dog chasing its tail. Once you get this started, it tends to run around on itself as a self-perpetuating cycle. So you have to break the cycle. You have to break the cycle and put back the integrity, the energy powerhouse of the cell, which is the role of the mitochondria. And the mitochondria, as you know, is a center for signal transduction as well as bioenergetics. It plays a very important role in regulating intracellular signals that modify organelle function within the cell and signal to the nucleus and the genome, messages that help regulate gene expression and ultimately proteomic effects within the cell. This is a very nice paper, actually was published in Free Radical Biology and Medicine, volume 37, page 1951 and 2004, talking about mitochondrial dysfunction and how it relates to oxidative stress, and it can ultimately lead to things that impact cardiovascular function and neurological function, particularly seen in things like epilepsy or central nervous system problems or seizure disorders, where the brain and heart are very dependent upon mitochondrial integrity for their function. We recognize that even modest mutations of mitochondrial DNA as a consequence of oxidative stress can have an adverse effect upon cognition. This has been shown in animal studies by inducing mitochondrial oxidative injuries to mitochondrial DNA. It leads to poor performance in mazes by animals and increased what you would call biological age with reduced cognitive and memory effects in the animal. By the way, this was found in Nature Genetics, volume 35, page 65. And we know in humans, very interesting paper that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine a number of years ago, this is volume 350, page 664 in 2004, that showed that impaired mitochondrial activity as a result of type 2 diabetes and insulin resistance then has adverse effects upon muscle cell function, on a neurologic function, and may contribute then to the impairment and the progressive degeneration seen in type 2 diabetes. In fact, mitochondrial dysfunction is associated very early on with insulin resistance, and they're very closely tied together, the metabolic syndrome, mitochondrial dysfunction. And again, I want to emphasize, I'm not talking about constitutive, inborn errors of mitochondrial function. I'm talking about induced effects that occur as a consequence of altered environment and altered physiologic status, in this case, hyperinsulinemia, insulin resistance, being associated with mitochondrial dysfunction. This is Science Magazine, volume 300, page 1140. So I think we can say that there is a very close correlation between chronic disease, neurologic, cardiovascular, metabolic disease, and the relationship to altered mitochondrial bioenergetics, oxidative stress, and how that may then relate to the need for specific phytochemicals that modulate intercellular signal transduction that can put these functions back on the rail, so to speak, that can help to regulate these altered control points that are set points that are associated with bioenergetic dysfunctions. So if you look at type 2 diabetes, for instance, if you intervene with a drug like glucophage or metformin, what you find is that metformin has a positive impact on mitochondrial metabolism, reduces mitochondrial oxidative stress, and it's one of the benefits that it imparts in the management of type 2 diabetes, which then subsequently has an effect on improved insulin signaling. So these are pleiotropic effects that these drugs have, or these agents have, just similar to that which we see with some of the phytochemicals. They don't just affect one function. They have effect across a broad array of functions, and that's why I think the term antioxidant that we apply to these plant-derived materials, like vitamin C is a simple example, but we certainly could talk about a whole array of other phytochemicals, is too simplistic a term. It's too general a term. We know that once insulin has been normalized, that that helps improve biochemical function and bioenergetics and lowering oxidative stress within the mitochondria. So it's a kind of a push-pull argument. You could say that improving biochemical bioenergetics at the mitochondrial level will improve insulin signaling, or you can say improving insulin signaling improves bioenergetics and reduces mitochondrial oxidative stress. So in some senses, I guess you would say that those therapies that improve insulin sensitivity are antioxidant by nature because they improve mitochondrial bioenergetics. As contrasted to those interventions that enhance mitochondrial dysfunction are associated with increased insulin resistance. Let's use an example. Let's give a very high sucrose diet to animals and look at what effect it has on mitochondrial bioenergetics and skeletal muscle and liver function. And what we find in these studies is that a very high sucrose, high sugar diet induces mitochondrial dysfunction, oxidative stress, and it's associated with altered skeletal muscle and liver function and increased apoptosis, cellular death in those tissues. Now, again, I want to emphasize that these are studies in which the sugar percentage calories have been greatly exaggerated in these animal studies to try to make a point. But I think what we're seeing, at least from the implied work of these studies, is that there is an effect mitigated by environmental choices on mitochondrial bioenergetics. So if you eat a diet that's devoid of phytochemicals, you eat a diet that's very high in fat and sugar, you're pushing mitochondrial bioenergetics and intracellular signal transduction towards the state of oxidative injury and towards an altered state of inflammation. So we know that this dysfunction occurs in the mitochondria of type 2 diabetics. We now have some sense as to the molecular mechanisms as to how this occurs at the cellular level that engages the mitochondrial dysfunction and its relationship to insulin signaling. And we know that insulin regulation of mitochondrial proteins adversely affects then, or has an effect upon, oxidative phosphorylation proteins in human muscle. So the story has certainly, I guess, expanded in its depth and density over the last 5 to 10 years, such that I think we can say that the environment does, in fact, influence mitochondrial bioenergetics, that we don't have to use the story of mitochondrial dysfunction as only an inborn error of metabolism story, that we can now look at an induced effect caused by altered lifestyle, environmental factors, exposure to chemicals, exposure to radiation, exposure to stress. All of these then can have impact upon bioenergetics, and that if we then take away the signal transduction normalizing substances, which are the phytochemicals in the diet that were part of our human history and our diet historically, that then further tips the balance towards increased dysfunctional signaling and altered bioenergetics. Now, clinically, what does this map against? I mean, I've talked about cardiac disorders, I've talked about neurological disorders, I've talked about dysinsulinism and associated that with cardiometabolic syndrome or with type 2 diabetes. What about things like the disorders of the 21st century, chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia syndrome, multiple chemical sensitivity syndrome, Gulf War syndrome? As you probably know from previous editions of Functional Medicine Update, we've talked at length with experts in the field on this very topic. Dr. Paul Cheney, just very recently, was one of our extraordinary contributors in our Clinician of the Month discussion about oxygen itself being a potential antioxidant when given in the right concentrations, and low oxygen tension ischemia being a prooxidant. We've talked with Dr. Martin Paul twice on our Functional Medicine Update Clinician and Researcher of the Month columns about the work of nitric oxide and its relationship to peroxynitrite and how that relates to oxidative mitochondrial uncoupling through the activation of the immune system and inflammatory response, and how chronic fatigue syndrome and fibromyalgia may be considered conditions at the cell pathology level associated with mitochondrial dysfunction and with this whole concept of inflammatory disorders and altered cellular signaling. In fact, recently it's been reported that if you look in the red blood cells of chronic fatigue syndrome patients, that you'll find very significant evidence of erythrocyte oxidative damage. This was recently published in the Archives of Medical Research, Volume 38, page 94, in 2007. And what they go on to say in the study is that there's a strong likelihood that this increase in erythrocyte oxidation seen in CSF is a manifestation of what occurs as a consequence of systemic increased inflammatory and oxidative response to the condition. So what the triggering agent is, I think, is still open for discussion, but the pathophysiology of chronic fatigue syndrome and fibromyalgia seems to have a relationship to the same story of activation of oxidative injury. In fact, if you go and look in the literature about the correlations between oxidative injury and multiple chemical sensitivity or oxidative injury and fibromyalgia, you'll come to see a number of papers that have been published that support this model very strongly. In the Federation Proceedings Journal, this is Fastive Journal, Volume 16, page 1407, was a paper authored by Dr. Paul showing that N-methyl-D-aspartate sensitization and stimulation by peroxynitrite, nitric oxide, as well as organic solvents may be a mechanism to explain chemical sensitivity, and it ties together with mitochondrial uncoupling and oxidative stress. Another paper that was published in Environmental Health Perspectives, Volume 111, and page 1461 in 2003, discusses elevated nitric oxide peroxynitrite as it relates to not only multiple chemical sensitivity, but also to neurological disorders, and ties together multiple chemical sensitivity to, again, mitochondrial uncoupling. So I think we're starting to witness a very interesting evolution of our understanding of the etiology of some of these complex disorders that associate themselves with muscle pain, cognitive dysfunction, immunological dysfunctions or lymphadenopathy, generalized bone weariness, inability to think clearly that we call foggy brain syndrome. All of these may be early manifestations of these conditions of oxidative stress, mitochondrial uncoupling. And then the question that's begged, of course, is what role does altered diet, if any, play in both the progression of these conditions and maybe the remediation by changing the diet to enhance the level of intake of specific cellular signaling substances, i.e. phytochemicals, that can modulate these processes? In fact, Dr. Bruce Ames, who, as you know, is a world-renowned investigator in this field, professor emeritus from the University of California, Berkeley Department of Biochemistry, and recently now working extensively at the Children's Hospital Oakland Research Institute, has authored a series of papers offering up some therapeutic potential that derives out of this model, one of which is in this article entitled A Role for Nutritional Supplements in Optimizing Health, what he calls the metabolic tune-up. This appeared in Archives of Biochemistry and Biophysics, Volume 423, page 227 in 2004. I was very fortunate to have a chance to both be present and have a conversation with Dr. Ames at a recent Bruce Ames symposium that was held in his honor at the University of California, Davis, on nutrigenomics and the effect of nutrients on the epigenome. Dr. Ames and I were talking about the role that micronutrients can play, vitamins and minerals and various phytochemicals on cellular function and mitochondrial oxidative phosphorylation and energetics and promotion of healthy aging. And he went on to say that if you just take a gross view of the role that these complex family of nutrients have, they help to stabilize genome. They prevent genomic instability. Genomic instability is a consequence of all sorts of adverse physiological functions or processes going on, one of which is related to oxidative injury that causes genome instability. Genome instability associates itself with cancer. It associates itself with increased cellular death. It associates itself with cardiopathies, with dysfunctional insulin signaling. So his concept is, as expressed in this article, a role for nutritional supplements in optimizing health, that if we feed the right nutrients in the right doses, we can provide the cofactors and signaling substances necessary to promote proper oxidative phosphorylation, bioenergetics, and mitochondrial energy production. So he talks about the things that we all know about, but often we forget about because they're so simple. Vitamins B12, folic acid, vitamin B6, vitamin C, E, minerals such as iron and zinc, which he says appears to mimic the ability to prevent radiation damage in cells and help to stabilize the genome against environmental enzyme difficulties. We also know that there are other cofactors that play roles in these processes, one of which is coenzyme Q10 ubiquinone. There are a series of papers that have been published demonstrating the role therapeutic intake of vitamin Q or coenzyme Q10 has on these processes, one of which was published entitled Nutritional Cofactor Treatment in Mitochondrial Disorders. This appeared in the Journal of the American Dietetic Association, Volume 103, page 1029 in 2003, showing that this very important role that coenzyme Q10 has in the oxidative phosphorylation profile helps to prevent uncoupling of factor 4 and establish appropriate bioenergetics in individuals who have a functional CoQ10 deficiency. So that may be people, for instance, on statin drugs, or that may be people that are under higher oxidative stress as a consequence of chemical exposure, psychological or environmental stresses. And so then a coenzyme Q10, which is not considered a vitamin as such, then becomes a functionally conditional nutrient for individuals with specific need, and doses between 50 and 100 milligrams a day of coenzyme Q10 then become valuable. We know that coenzyme Q10 supplements will improve mitochondrial function and tissue levels, not only of CoQ10, but also vitamin E helps to maintain proper tocopherol levels in tissues. This is demonstrated in a study in the Journal of Nutrition, Volume 133, page 3175, published in 2003. And we know that coenzyme Q10 works along with another interesting mitochondrially active nutrient, conditionally essential nutrient, that's L-carnitine. And there are a number of papers that have been published over the years on the efficacy of supplementation with L-carnitine for individuals who have compromised nutritional status, increased mitochondrial oxidative stress, and fatigue as a presenting symptom. This is a very interesting paper that was published actually in the Journal of Nutrition, Volume 22, page 136 in 2006, on the use of L-carnitine therapy, giving 1,000 milligrams a day to patients who had fatigue and were undergoing anti-cancer therapy, showing the improvement in mitochondrial function by lowering oxidative stress. So I think what we're starting to witness is a very interesting relationship between a modified nutritional environment and promotion of proper intracellular signaling and bioenergetics, which ultimately regulates the integrity of cellular function. There is a program that's been put out there that a number of clinicians are using called the Marshall Protocol for treating chronic fatigue syndrome. It's built around trying to use some of these cofactor materials like NADH in supplemental levels to try to activate bioenergetics and reducing factor. I think the takeaway that we've had over the years and from the papers that we've published in this area indicates it's not a silver bullet of any one specific intervention. It's lowering the environmental stress that induces mitochondrial uncoupling and oxidative injury. It's improving intracellular signaling by putting a person back on a diet that's rich and complex with regard to phytochemicals, getting them away from sugar, fat, alcohol, and caffeine in excessive doses, and then properly supplementing specific nutrients like those that Dr. Eames talks about in his metabolic tune-up, and the rich array of phytochemicals that regulate bioenergetics. With that as a conceptual framework, let's move to our researcher of the month, and I think we'll take this discussion to the next level of your understanding and open up all sorts of new potential doors for both therapeutics and prevention. So I'd like to introduce Dr. Marianne Lila. Well, once again, we're at that portion of our monthly functional medicine update that I know you and I both look forward to with great anticipation, and that's our researcher or clinician of the month section. And this month, I feel very privileged to have an individual who's a very well-respected professional in the area of phytochemistry and is actually at the University of Illinois is doing work as a head of the College of Agriculture, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences program, the Global Connect portion of what's called ACES, that stands for Agriculture, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences at the University of Illinois. Beyond that, however, she's done extraordinary work in understanding the phytochemistry of bioactive components of plants. And what got me started down the road to really want to have the opportunity to speak with her was a wonderful paper that she authored in the Journal of Science of Food and Agriculture. It was a perspective paper entitled The Nature-Nurture Debate on Bioactive Phytochemicals, the Genome versus the Terroir. And this appeared in Volume 86, page 2510 in 2006. So, Dr. Marianne Lila, we really welcome you to Functional Medicine Update and want to thank you for giving us some of your valuable time. And I guess let me start the question first by saying, what got you personally into the whole area of bioactives from food and the role that phytochemicals have in nutrition?
Well, it's interesting because I've been working in nutritional sciences here for the last 15 years, but my actual training, my PhD research, was in plant sciences. So it's kind of a strange but very useful blend of expertise because most of my colleagues that I interact with in nutritional sciences are very good at doing bioassays on compounds, looking for their mechanisms of action in the human body, but really have very little understanding of how a plant makes these compounds and why a plant is enticed to make certain compounds. They're not doing it for altruism. They're doing it for their own survival. But it's been a real good blend of talents to be able to use what I know about plants in order to control or to enhance what a plant can do for human health.
So let's talk just briefly about the point you just made, because for many of our listeners, they may not be familiar with this concept about secondary metabolites from plants or even primary metabolites that we call phytochemicals. And why do plants make them? It seems like it takes a lot of their metabolic energy to go to that work. And some of these molecules are very sophisticated in structure. So tell us a little bit about why phytochemicals are in plants from a teleological perspective.
That's really a good question. It costs the plant quite a bit in terms of energy to produce a secondary compound. They're called secondary compounds because they're not essential for the plant to grow and develop. So a plant that's growing under ideal conditions of sunlight and fertility will put all of its energy into simply growing and photosynthesizing. But when it has some kind of stress or insult in the environment, it will cease or slow down the growth process and start putting some of its resources instead into producing secondary compounds that will protect it, perhaps against an herbivore, an insect predator, maybe protect it against intense UV light, salt stress, all these kinds of things that can otherwise damage plant tissues. The secondary metabolites can inhibit those stressors in the environment. And so a plant, being a sessile organism, really has no choice. It has to chemically protect itself, and it uses a diversity of different mechanisms, not just one magic bullet to do each task. It uses a lot of redundancy, a lot of overlapping chemicals or similar chemicals that all together will protect it. So there's a lot of interactions going on when a plant has its chemical cocktail together to protect itself. And interestingly, these same compounds that a plant uses to protect itself will interact with human therapeutic targets and help to prevent or provide therapy against human disease, or just enhance the human metabolism. So it's really a huge benefit to the consumer of these plants.
So just to give our listeners a quick thumbnail as to the broad range of experiences you've had from your research, I'm looking at some of your recent publications that have titles like Identification of Isoflavone Glycosides from Puerperia Lobata, Comparative Evaluation of Anticancer Properties of European and American Elderberry Fruits, Biorane diterpenoids from the heartwood and effects that they have, serum testosterone being reduced in short-term lycopene or tomato power consumption in F344 rats, comparative phytochemical characterization of rhodiola species, and so forth and so forth. So obviously you've had a very broad range of experiences looking at these secondary metabolites in plants. Have you found from these that there are differences in, say, individual cultivars in how they produce the phytochemicals? And then beyond the cultivars, are there differences in how the environment influences gene expression and secondary metabolite biosynthesis in an individual cultivar? So that gets into this question of nature versus nurture and how it reflects in the plant, their output.
There's absolutely huge genotype differences in how a single species of plant will produce a secondary metabolite. The reason I have that diversity of looking at all kinds of different phytochemicals, as you've just listed, is because I'm part of a botanical center for age-related diseases, which is actually based in Purdue, looking specifically at metabolites from plants that will help bone health or dementia or other age-related diseases. And then I'm also part of a International Cooperative Biodiversity Group, which is working in Central Asia, looking at their plants that have bioactive properties that have been, because they're former Soviet Union, have been totally hidden from Western medicine for all these years, the whole Soviet regime. And now that these countries, Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, and Tajikistan, now that they are independent countries and rather impoverished, they're looking for opportunities to really validate some of their natural medicines that have been hidden from the West and really have some tremendous properties. Now, the reason that I've been working specifically in Central Asia is that these are some of the most inland countries in the world. This gets to the whole point of why a plant produces secondary metabolites and what makes different plants produce different metabolites. Now, they're inland countries. That means that they are not buffered by the ocean at all. That means that they have the very hot summers, very cold winters. That means that the plants that survive there, that manage to survive in these environments, are extremely stressed. And as a result, will be extremely jam-packed with secondary metabolites. They may not be beautiful, but they definitely are full of metabolites that have benefit for human health. When you mention different cultivars, one of the problems that we have is that conventional breeding has tended, not on purpose, but just because we have been selecting plants for beauty, for keeping quality, shipping ability, sweetness, we have been breeding out secondary metabolites in many of our wild species and producing a commodity for the supermarket that has a good shelf life and is attractive. So one thing that I have looked at quite a bit is going back to the wild, going back to plants that are enduring stress in the wild, that aren't pampered in the field, and seeing what we can learn about their secondary metabolites and seeing what we can do to maybe get some of these back into conventional mainstream vegetables and fruits for the American public, and also look at some commodities that maybe haven't been available or are underappreciated in the American marketplace, but maybe are known locally in different countries for their value as foods and medicine.
Wow, you have said so much in that that just...
And I completely forget the original question.
No, you didn't. That just leads me to an exploding series of thoughts. We recently interviewed on Functional Medicine Update Dr. Christoph Westphal, who is the CEO of Sirtris Pharma, who has made these discoveries about the SIRT1 and 2 genes and their relationship to certain effects on the epigenome. Particularly, he spoke about resveratrol, but he also identified many other compounds that they're working on as well. And the concept really was born out of a discovery and a term that was coined by Dr. David Sinclair at Harvard that I know you're familiar with, called xenohormesis, that there are small levels of substances that can initiate through signal transduction processes larger effects on physiology than we might have expected based upon the small amount that actually might have gotten in the body. So you get this amplification effect of the right molecule at the right place or the right combination of molecules. And so obviously you've just been speaking into what probably Sinclair and Christoph would call a xenohormesis concept. And you've also spoken, I think, to possibly the difference between a product produced by organic agriculture versus that is produced by a less stressed, non-organic environment. Is there any validity to that concept that this might help explain a difference in composition between organic and non-organic?
It may well. I will have to say that there have been very little scientific replicated trials to really validate this point. Logically, it makes sense based on what we know about wild versus cultivated. Organic being a very low input crop, low pesticides, natural fertility, a lot more stresses, it makes good sense that organic crop would have higher content of natural phytochemicals and therefore more health benefit. There really hasn't been a whole lot of replicated trials. And I'm not quite sure why that is, because it's a real good argument and it needs to be done.
So let's also talk a little bit about another theme that you described for us, and that's the difference between, say, single molecules versus mixtures of molecules. The plant produces, as you said, these families of molecules, And in fact, in one of your review papers, I can't remember if it was the recent Annals of New York Academy of Sciences paper, From Beans to Berries and Beyond, Teamwork Between Plant Chemicals for Protection of Optimal Health, or it was in the Nature versus Nurture debate on bioactive phytochemicals, but you made the point that plants may produce a different repertoire or a different portfolio of phytochemicals based upon different environmental circumstances. They have the gene potential to produce different families, and they select based on certain growing conditions which family they'll produce. That leads us to believe then that there must be some benefit in these, quote, anti-stress compounds for specific types of stressors as mixtures, not as single molecules.
Absolutely the case. And I think that's why America has been so slow compared to a lot of other countries in really embracing the concept of foods as medicine, because we're kind of a pharmacy-oriented big pharma country. The pharma industry will look at compounds that are of value using high-throughput screens that will look at the effect on one enzyme, multiple samples looking at one enzyme, and that's the bioassays that they use. A plant is very, very different, a plant extract, because it's maybe hitting multiple targets at once and maybe at lower levels than a single synthetic compound. So big pharma has not been ready to embrace plants as a source of medicine for that reason. Plants change their own metabolism and their own output of secondaries very much in response to the environment. We're looking, for example, at berries that are growing in Alaska. And this is an extremely stressful environment. This is an EPA-funded project because we're looking at this tribal resource. It's native Alaskans who use berries for health, specifically diabetes. And what is happening to these berries in the face of global warming? And so we're looking at three different locations in Alaska, one that's very, very far north, a whaling village way up on the northern coast of Alaska, one that's halfway out on the Aleutian Islands, and one that's in southern Alaska. And we're looking at how the same species of berry will differ in phytochemical composition given its location, and how climate change is actually impacting on the not just the survival of these plants, but the composition of the bioactive compounds in them. In some cases, it's not all bad in terms of bioactivity, just depending on how the climate is changing, if it's drought conditions, if it's flood. But warming in itself is something that's very much shifting. The high antioxidant potential of these berries, it's changing because of global warming.
As it changes, have you seen a different ORAC value, or however we would measure in a gross sense antioxidant capability of the global warming grow on berries? Does it increase the ORAC, or does it decrease, or does it change certain characteristics of oxygen radical absorbing capacity?
That's a long-term study to actually look at the impact of global warming, because this is a slow process. But what we're doing is looking at different environmental locations right now in the state of Alaska, which is a huge state, which have natural changes in their climatic conditions, measuring differences in the same species based on what's naturally there now and what is shifting, so we can predict how global warming will be changing some of these. The ORAC values, they're extremely high now in Alaska just because sometimes 23 hours day length during the growing season, so intense UV light. The prediction is that the ORAC may be decreased. The antioxidant value should be decreased if they're less stressed, if they have less cold temperature. But this remains to be seen. We need to really be able to look at this over a period of time.
One of the questions that I've had asked to me, and I think it's a good question that you would be much more likely as an expert to help us understand, is when a plant is stressed and it produces these anti-stress family of secondary metabolites, be it either to cold stress, UV stress, insect stress, whatever it might be, a different portfolio maybe for different types of stresses, does it also run the risk for human consumption of raising the production of potentially toxic metabolites for the human? I'm thinking of an example I learned about celery years ago, that celery, when grown under stress conditions, can produce a higher level of certain compounds called sorrelins that can induce allergy in some people. So I guess it begs the question, does this always produce a beneficial effect for a human who might consume the food?
No, you're quite right. Not always a beneficial effect. But I would say that the incidence of actually finding a toxic effect is very rare in these cases under the stressed plants. We always tend to look in our research at plants that have a long history of human use, maybe not known to the American market, but a long history of human use in whatever country we are visiting, so that we aren't going for something that's going to be a natural toxin. Plants, of course, are wonderful chemists, and they have some of the most deadly poisons that are out there. But we are always looking at those things that have a long traditional use.
Now, I've noticed another area that you've been involved with from your publications related to your research is the concept of bioavailability. And I think this is another big area of seemingly controversy in the field, because people have said, well, you know, a lot of these bioactive compounds from plants, which seem active in a test tube, in vitro experiment in cell culture, when given to animals, they're highly bio-unavailable, and therefore they really don't have any effect on the organism. But of course, that assumes that there's some kind of a direct dose-response relationship, and they don't go through some xenohormetic mechanism. So tell us a little bit about your understanding of this bioavailability question.
It's quite true that when we consume foods and we know a certain compound in the food is bioactive, for example, resveratrol in red wine, sometimes we cannot see the dose response effect that we are used to looking at with synthetic pharmacological compounds. This is in part because it's just beyond the sensitivity of our instruments, and in part because the real way that plants are working is this mixture of compounds, not one single compound that should be increasing in its dose response. So those are complications that have hurt the research or hurt the acceptance of plants as a source of medicines in the medical community. But what we are finding is that the medical industry, for example, just the medical practitioners were unwilling to accept the whole concept of red wine being heart protective because they didn't see the bioavailability. There very little of it actually seemed to get into the bloodstream. Now, with more sophisticated methods of measuring metabolites in the bloodstream, we're seeing that maybe what we eat, what we actually consume, is immediately being metabolized into something that we weren't expecting. And in the blood, which has a rather neutral pH, an anthocyanin, for example, that's in red wine, is going to be metabolized into other molecules like chalcones, which are not recognizable as the original compound that was eaten. So there may be things that we're not measuring because they've become something else. One thing that we're doing in our lab, which is a little bit groundbreaking, but it's been a lot of fun, is we've been able to take some of these plants that produce bioactive compounds, like tomatoes that produce lycopene and all the lycopene precursors that are beneficial for prostate cancer. We have been looking at grapes and resveratrols and flavonoids in the grapes that are beneficial for cardiovascular and anti-cancer effects and other things as well. And we've been looking at other sources of isoflavones, like kudzu, for example, which is a noxious weed in the south of the United States, but it's a wonderful ingredient for isoflavones in Chinese herbal medicine. We've been looking at all these things and growing them in cell culture, plant cell culture, or in organ culture, like rapidly growing roots of kudzu in test tubes. And when we feed these plants in tissue culture, when we feed them a radiolabeled source of sugar, the metabolites become radiolabeled. Then we are able to isolate radiolabeled isoflavones, for example, feed them to rodent models, and absolutely see where that label goes. Is it localized in the liver? Does it pass the blood-brain barrier? How long is it in the bloodstream, and how quickly is it excreted? So we've been able to see where some of these metabolites, which by our conventional measurements, we didn't think they were really getting in there, or we didn't think that measurable levels were getting into the bloodstream. We're able to see that something is getting in there, some kind of metabolite from the original labeled compound is definitely passing through the animal, localizing in certain organs. For the first time last summer, we were able to show, through collaboration with our colleagues at Purdue and the Center for Age-Related Diseases, we're able to show that flavonoids from grape, when eaten, when ingested by rats, were able to pass through the blood-brain barrier and be localized in regions of the brain, which accounts for why you have some anti-Alzheimer's and anti-Parkinson's disease effects from these metabolites, even though we weren't able to measure them getting into the brain because we didn't know what we were looking for once they're metabolized. So this radio labeling has been a real key to show where these things are going and how they are actually working.
That is really fascinating. So in essence, it sounds a little bit like what you're doing is ADME work with the natural phytochemicals, absorption, distribution, metabolism, excretion, which is like a phase one type of IND, mm-hmm. except here we're dealing with nature's laboratory of phytochemicals. And once you've determined the metabolites and their localization and excretion, then I guess the next question is, what is their bioactivity? Could they be more bioactive than the original materials that were put in the mouth? And So then you get into ex vivo analyses, which probably you're looking at some studies along that line as well, I would imagine.
Where we are just now, yes.
That's very exciting. So that raises, for me, a very interesting, provocative question. I mean, there's so many interesting questions that are provoked by your work and your comments, but one that strikes me is, you've described the mixtures of molecules that are produced in response to environmental factors working on the genome of the plant and its unique, specific book of life. That then produces these secondary phytochemicals, which then have an influence on the physiology of the plant. Then we consume that plant, possibly, let's say it's an edible plant, and those anti-stress compounds in the plant then are absorbed at some level and have some impact either directly or through metabolism, as you just described, and get localized in certain organs or tissues. And then there's been this long-standing question as to whether these mixtures of molecules serve as some adaptogens, and that's a term that floats around in the botanical medicine literature for a long period of time. It's kind of one of those words that doesn't seem to have a specific definition, but it says that low levels of something help the body to adapt to stress. And I'm wondering, these compounds that are in these mixtures, undoubtedly, if we do a traditional pharmacological evaluation, they would probably have very high IC50s, meaning that it would be considered fairly low potency molecules in comparison to a new-to-nature molecule that had come out of drug discovery. But the mixture of these molecules, as you've described them, even though their individual potencies may be low, may influence physiology in such a way as to produce this normalization effect, which is called adaptogenic. Am I at all moving?
No, exactly right. Adaptogen would be something that increases the nonspecific resistance of an organism. And that's the definition that we use. Actually, that's one of the main foci of our work in Central Asia, in the stands, because the Soviet regime was very interested in plant extracts that would help as an adaptogen, would help reduce fatigue, increase endurance, reduce hypoxia for soldiers climbing over the mountains, things like that, that would just enhance human metabolism. So many of the root crops that we've been working with there definitely have these adaptogenic effects. So that's exactly one of our areas of research.
So this would be like your rhodiola rosea?
That's one of them, and ajuga is another one. Ajuga turkestanica, which, you know, it's something that's actually used in some countries. Ajuga leaves are used in salads, you know, just like arugula. They're very similar, actually, but just something we haven't really embraced in the United States. We don't know about it, but in other countries it is used, different kinds of ajuga. And, you know, these kind of things, if we can find an adaptogenic effect, what they have is a compound called a phytoectosteroid. So it's a steroid-like compound. It has the same shape as a steroid without the bad effects of a metabolic steroid. So it's a natural steroid-like compound that increases resistance. And some of these ajugas have very high levels in their leaves. But, you know, spinach is another mainstream vegetable that has low levels of phytoectosteroids. So maybe back when the Popeye cartoon was on, you know, before a lot of things were bred out of spinach, Popeye wasn't kidding when he ate his spinach and he had the good muscle mass, because those phytoectosteroids really do help in endurance and muscle mass.
So I'm now going to ask the very provocative kind of philosophical question. What you've just described, obviously, is a whole different way of looking at pharmaceutical science. It's a different way of looking at medicinal chemistry. It's a different way of looking at even therapeutic, let's call it preventive and chronic disease management, than the traditional method that we have taught generations of health providers to practice their medicine from. So how long will it take, do you think, to filter this message that you're describing into a place where it can actually make a difference in clinical practice?
We're just at that point now, because finally, just in the last few years, we've come up with screening methods that are high content, that we can look at the effect of multiple genes at once, putting a plant extract on a cancer cell line, for example, and look at the effect on multiple genes at once, or doing reverse transcriptase PCR to look at multiple targets at once. So finally we have the tools to look at an extract that is not like a pharmaceutical compound, but has multiple targets. And we can get to the bottom of what's working. We have always been very good breeders in this country, and well, throughout the world, you know, we can get traits into plants that we want. But we haven't known what to look for until now. We're just at the breakthrough point where we're figuring out what compounds and what mixtures of compounds are important. And with the correct tools, which we now have at our fingertips, we're able to either put new health-enhancing properties into mainstream fruits and vegetables or introduce fruits and vegetables from other parts of the world that are underappreciated, underrecognized in the United States, and get them into our marketplace so that we have wonderful health protective sources so people can responsibly select foods for their own diet and for the diet of their families with health in mind, not just calories and nutrition, but health protective properties.
Oh, that's really very, very exciting. So my last question is, given that you are an expert in this field, what plant foods do you consider at this point most interesting from a health perspective based on these phytochemical arrays, and why?
The most exciting one for me has been the wild blueberry. And this is a particular species of blueberry, Vaccinium angustifolium. It grows only in maritime provinces of Canada and coastal Maine. The reason this is so exciting to me is this berry has such a variety of health protective effects. We've found anti-cancer effects. And not just anti-cancer, one enzyme is knocked out. We have effects against the promotion, initiation, and proliferation stages of cancer from berry extracts. And different compounds in the berry are giving protection at all these different stages of carcinogenesis. There's cardioprotective effects with wild blueberry, anti-diabetic effects, anti-infection, dental health effects. One of my colleagues at Tufts University is doing cognitive and motor function with age-related diseases and how berries can actually help relieve an aging patient who has memory loss. You can bring back memory. So it's amazing to me that this little berry has such a variety of different benefits for human health. Now, all blueberries are great. All blueberries are in a class by themselves, but the wild blueberry in particular has been just phenomenal.
And that's a really great little insight for us. And, you know, you make a wonderful comment. We make a number of wonderful comments, but one that stands out in the close here is the comment that it's very interesting that some of these phytochemical mixtures derived from plants have effect on physiological processes across a wide range of diseases. It's not like one plant for one disease, and which
exactly.
It's more for a mechanism, which I think is a very interesting concept.
That's absolutely true. I guess the coevolution of animals and plants probably contribute to that. It's in a time scale that's beyond my comprehension, but we find plants as sources of biologically active molecules and mixtures that we just simply don't find in any synthetic source.
Is there anything that you would want to leave if you were talking to several thousand health practitioners who are going out to give recommendations to their patients? Is there anything that you would want them to think about as they go into those exam rooms with their patients, given all this extraordinary new information?
Oh, just stay tuned, because I really think we're at the point of huge breakthroughs for fruits and vegetables in particular. People now who want to be proactive about their health are so willing to go into health food stores and buy echinacea extract and ginkgo extract. Not that these things are bad, but they'll buy these little tablets with exotic things in them. But we have really some specifically health protective phytochemicals in mainstream fruits and vegetables, and we can enhance those in mainstream fruits and vegetables and bring them to the diet, to the American table. And so really, just stay tuned, because these things are going to be coming out more and more now that the research is just flourishing.
Well, Dr. Mary Ann Lila, I want to thank you so much both for the extraordinary work you've done and for the eloquent way you present it. It gets us all pretty excited about what the future may be for both prevention and maybe even therapeutic medicine, that where these concepts get integrated into the exam and treatment room. So thank you very, very much for the time that you spent with us.
Sure enough.
Well, we want to thank Dr. Lila once again for that extraordinarily insightful and provocative series of comments and discussion about her own work and that of the field. Can you see the future of medicine and where it's going to integrate this, quote, new pharmacology, which I find to be almost an ironic term, new? This is historic pharmacology. This is the way we ate in times before standing agriculture and when the foods evolved through time with us. And the largest laboratory experiment that has ever been done was that of evolution and natural selection, where the interaction of our food supply with the human physiology and its genetic structure was that which had been evolved over millennia. And, you know, we've obviously intervened and modified this relationship somewhat with standing agriculture, new cultivars, the way that we grow food products by taking the stress off the plants with herbicides and various biocides and fertilizers and sun protection, and all of these things change the family of these secondary metabolites that then modulate human function in different ways. So it's a very fascinating chapter in nutritional medicine that we're starting to see opened up, which is to support a lot of what has been discussed within the field that's called the natural foods sector for some tens of years. In fact, going back into the 18th century, we saw the origins of these concepts of natural, minimally processed foods having a different effect on physiology than processed foods. So it's a very, very interesting chapter in the evolution of our understanding. And of course, there's all sorts of extraordinary numbers of papers coming from many highly competent research labs around the world that are adding depth and dimensions to this story. For instance, just recently in the journal Cancer Research, volume 66, page 5960, an article entitled Grapeseed Extract as an Aromatase Inhibitor and a Suppressor of Aromatase Expression was published, showing again the wide pleiotropic effects that many of these secondary metabolites have on physiological function in mammals. As you know, aromatase is the enzyme that converts androgens to estrogens, and it's expressed at higher levels in breast tissues, and particularly breast cancer tissues and normal breast tissue. There have been many synthetic compounds that have been studied and some approved, Aromadex being one, for the blocking of the aromatase enzyme to result in lowered estrogen levels in situ in localized tissues. But the question has been raised for some time, were there natural substances in a complex minimally processed diet that could influence this A-ring aromatization of the steroid nucleus from androgens to estrogens and therefore have estrogen modulating effects? And one of those that's been discovered in this particular paper is grapeseed extract containing high levels of procyanidin dimers that have been shown to be reasonably potent inhibitors of aromatase. And this, again, I want to emphasize, was a combination of in vitro studies and also animal study, looking in vitro at the MCF7 breast cancer cells. These are cells that are immortalized as a consequence of having undergone transition to cancer cells. It's been shown that grapeseed extract has a very beneficial effect on preventing the production locally by these cells of estrogens from androgen precursors, and also in animal interventions was shown to lower the production of estrogens in specific tissues, in this case breast tissue. So it seems to be that these procyanidins have a aromatase inhibition effect, or let's call it modulating effect, and suppress then localized production of estrogens. So that's just another of the myriad pleiotropic examples that demonstrate the wide range of physiological functions these secondary metabolites can have. Another of those that was described in this discussion with Dr. Lila was Pueria lobata, or the kudzu isoflavones, and they have unique estrogen modulating effects as well that are different than the soy isoflavones, which are genistein and didazine principally. A paper that was published in Plantae Medica, volume 66, page 572, talks about these isoflavones that are unique to the Pueria lobata and Pueria muricica family and how they influence estrogen receptor activities, alpha and beta, and without having a kind of the estrogen drive for mitosis that you see with 17-beta-estradiol can modulate estrogen functional status at the receptor site. So again, many different influences that these plant phytochemicals have as we use this kind of complementary concept that agents in plants evolved as anti-stress compounds that then have physiological normalizing or anti-stress effects in the human. And, of course, that raises the broad question about what kind of diet delivers the highest level of these phytochemicals. And that's a diet that's minimally processed, rich in vegetable foods, fruits and vegetables, and whole grains. And so is there any difference that we can ascribe to a vegetarian diet in health outcomes in the human? And, of course, this, although has been a reasonably controversial topic in some bodies of literature, I think the data over years has come to pass to say that a well-balanced vegetarian diet providing adequate levels of protein and vitamins and minerals, in fact, delivers in population-based epidemiological studies good health outcome, looking at Seventh-day Adventists, looking at groups of people who elected to be on vegan diets. The health outcomes look very favorable. In fact, blood pressure regulation in vegetarian diets was a topic of a recent review paper in Nutrition Reviews, authored by Susan Burkow and Neil Barnard. This was in the January 2005 issue, volume 63, page 1 through 8. talking about high blood pressure and its management with vegetable-based diets, it gets translated into the DASH-type diet, the DASH, dietary approaches towards stopping hypertension. And there is many papers, if you do a meta-analysis of roles that vegetable-based diets have on blood pressure, you're going to pick up over 20 papers that have all shown positive benefit as a consequence of the nutrient composition of vegetable diets, not only the mineral content of potassium and magnesium with low sodium, but also the high level of phytochemicals that serve as vascular active substances that help to improve endothelial function. And we even know that the diets that are very high in these phytochemicals have been ascribed as anti-cancer diets and have preventive oncological effects. There's a very nice paper that appeared in the Journal of Clinical Oncology, volume 25, page 2345 in 2007, entitled Greater Survival After Breast Cancer in Physically Active Women with High Vegetable Fruit Intake, Regardless of Obesity, again showing that there must be something of interest related to the portfolio or the profile of these phytochemicals and how they influence outcome in a secondary prevention trial in women who have had breast cancer. So I think that we're starting to see the convergence of various lines of observation and intervention research ranging from epidemiological human work to animal studies to in vitro work to cell culture work to even now some intervention trials. In fact, there's a wonderful prospective study of the relationship between fruit and vegetable intake and the risk of prostate cancer that was recently published. This is in the Journal of the National Cancer Institute, volume 99, page 1200 in 2007. That showed a very positive correlation between high intake of cruciferous vegetables, including broccoli and cauliflower, and a reduction in the relative risk of aggressive prostate cancer, particularly extraprostatic disease. So what we're starting to witness is a kind of a convergence of our observational and almost intuitional thoughts that high vegetable and fruit and whole grain diets play a positive role in health, and now the mechanistic underpinning of that, and the fact that different cultivars grown in different conditions can have differing levels of these beneficial phytochemicals. So it's an exciting story, and we thank Dr. Lila very much for adding another chapter to our evolving understanding. We'll look forward to seeing you next month in Functional Medicine Update.
Functional Medicine Update is copyrighted by Synthesis LLC by Dr. Jeffrey Black. Reproduction in any form is prohibited.